You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
Hello and welcome everybody to Social Europe Podcast episode 29. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. Today I'm in conversation with Branko Milanović, who is one of the world's leading experts on inequality. We're discussing why and how inequality has become such a big issue and how it relates to other issues such as the rise of wiping populism and immigration policy. The chat was recorded at the Eurofound Forum 2017 in Dublin. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Right. So, Branko Milanović, thank you very much for joining me today to discuss inequality, a topic that you have done an awful lot of research on. You're one of the globally leading experts on this. Let me kick the conversation off by asking you a very general question. Why is inequality such a big issue and why is it so corrosive to societies?
Well, let me, if I understand your question correctly, let me first say that why I think inequality became such a big issue, like in a public sort of domain, and I think it became a big issue because, I think essentially because of the crisis. Because what the crisis did was that people realized when, for example, their houses were repossessed or they couldn't repay the mortgage and so on, and actually they had to pay debts, they realized that for a long time, the middle class in the United States, and less so in Western Europe, but still, was living by able to borrow, or living well, and keeping up with the Joneses, whereas the real incomes have not risen. And then they have noticed that, of course, some people at the top have done extremely well over that time. So I believe that was this issue which brought the realization of this issue which brought inequality to the fore. Now, why is inequality in general important? I think it is important even for economic growth. And let me just put it in very simple terms, we know that in societies where inequality is extremely high, we have a cementing of privileges across generations. We don't have intergenerational mobility. We have lots of people who are never able to contribute to society by working or by studying or anything else because simply they don't have money to actually engage in that. So very high inequality is clearly not good. On the other hand, we have the example of formerly socialist economies that actually reduced inequality to such an extent that there was no incentive to even work harder or to, you know, study. So that low level of inequality was unsustainable too and bad for growth. So clearly, I think that we have to realize that not only there is some kind of a optimal level of inequality, but there are two different types of inequalities. Like there are two different types of cholesterol. There is inequality which is good, which is actually leads us to take risks, work hard, or study. And there is inequality which is bad, which essentially enables an elite to maintain its position without contributing much to society.
Okay, and if you look at the sort of main driver of inequalities globally and also maybe particular trends within Europe, what do you consider the main drivers?
Well, you know, globally, we have the situation now that global inequality measured by the standard indicators like the Gini coefficient is down. Now, it is down because of the increase of incomes and the rise of Asia, essentially China, India, and so forth. However, we are also not capturing well the very top incomes. First of all, because in surveys, these people are few in numbers and they don't participate, or they actually reveal incomes that are lower than actual incomes, or they try to hide, you know, incomes as we have seen in the Panama Papers or now in the Paradise Papers. So it could be when we make some adjustments for that, we actually find that the decline, it's very difficult to reverse the decline of global inequality even after the adjustment, but it certainly becomes much more moderated. And further, if we were to compare the incomes of the very top to the incomes to the median, then inequality by that measure has gone up. So that's about the global inequality. Now, in individual country levels, The situations obviously vary, and they vary especially after the crisis. But if we take a longer-term view and compare, let's suppose, mid-1980s to today, we see an increase in inequality practically in all rich countries. I think in the case of OECD countries, like with exception of two or three, inequality went up everywhere. And then, of course, we see an increase in inequality in China, Russia, India. South Africa, for example, which already had a high inequality, even went up. The only exceptions to that are countries in Latin America, which are really at a very high level of inequality, like Brazil, but had a decline over the last 15 years.
And in Europe in particular, do you see any specific trends?
Well, in Europe, the basic trend for all individual countries, again, over that long term, is an increase. We have a situation of countries like Sweden that are, of course, still hailed as a sort of exemplars of social democracy, but the increase of inequality in Sweden has been pretty significant. That doesn't make Sweden an unequal country, but while its sort of level of inequality was significantly below the EU average, it has now converged towards the inequality in other countries. And we see inequality increase in, after the crisis, in particular Spain, Greece, Portugal, which always had very high inequality with the UK, and then Central European countries that used and remain countries with relatively low inequality, but they are also small countries, very homogeneous in terms of education, ethnically as well, like Hungary, Austria, Slovak Republic, Czech Republic, Slovenia. They are countries with relatively low inequality.
And if we take a sort of a bit of a broader view, you know, and link inequality to some of the other sort of key and dominating issues at the forefront of political debate, namely globalization and migration, how do you see inequality interacting with globalization and migration?
You see, I would actually see there like globalization on top. In other words, I would see globalization as this framework that exists now, because we have now much more interdependent and interconnected than we were in history. When I say we, it's like just citizens of the world. Capital flows today much more freely, probably ever, with the possible exception of the end of the 19th century. Labor is somewhat less mobile than then, because in terms of the flows over the population which existed then, they were bigger than they are now. But these flows are definitely increasing nowadays. Obviously, technology, we are much more interdependent. So the globalization is, I think, that framework. And then within that framework, we have changes in inequality. Some of them, as I mentioned before, quite favorable, like inequality decline of global inequality due to growth rates of China and India. But some of them, I think, related to globalization as well, which are unfavorable. That's the increase of inequality in most of the rich countries and the hollowing out of the middle class. So I would really take, as I said, globalization as the main framework. Now, within that framework, we talked about inequality, and we also talk about migration, because migration is simply one of the manifestations of globalization. And that is a very difficult topic, because there again you find this sort of a trade-off between the two levels. You can argue, I think quite persuasively, that greater migration would reduce global inequality. It would certainly reduce global poverty. So that's something which is good. On the other hand, migration might lead to increases of inequality in some countries, as migrants actually put a further pressure on wages domestically, and it might lead to political problems. So basically, there is a trade-off there. We cannot opt, I believe, for the extreme solutions. Free migration would be not politically feasible, and then cutting migration off to zero, I think, would be economically sort of self-destructive, even for the countries that would do that.
Mm-hmm. And especially the issues of progressing globalization and migration, also inequality, have been recently linked to the rise of right-wing populism across Western societies. How do you see this particular link?
Yes, they've been linked, and I think that there is a consistent, I think, pattern or consistent story that can be told. We don't have, as of yet, too many empirical studies. Actually, I've seen only two, one for the United States and one for Europe. And I'm in a sort of what these studies tend to suggest is that the underlying reason for the what is called populism, or let's suppose election or support of non-mainstream leaders or parties, was economic, but that it was sort of channeled through cultural channel. In other words, what I think is that the story which is being told there is that because of lack of economic advancement, because of dissatisfaction with economic position, maybe insecure jobs, decline in wages, loss of job, for example, for your partner, inability to send your kids to good school because they are expensive. You, of course, have a pool of dissatisfied people, and then they are expressing dissatisfaction by blaming somebody else for what happened. So they could blame the elite, they could blame Chinese, they can blame migrants. But I really believe, and I think these studies confirm that actually the main driver is economic dissatisfaction.
And it's often seen now in recent research that it's basically an interplay between socioeconomic factors as well as cultural factors. I mean, one of the discussions we had recently with Peter Hall from Harvard actually showed that, you know, even though you can explain a lot of the rise of right-wing populism in the United States and in Europe with socioeconomic factors, but that kind of explanation doesn't sit as easily with countries such as Hungary and Poland, who've actually had a very good economic development and nevertheless turned into right-wing populism. Do you see any sort of cultural factors that play into this as well?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because for that I have a slightly different view, and actually I'm planning to do a blog on this. I think that what is happening in Eastern Europe and unwillingness to accept migrants in Eastern Europe stems from two developments which have sort of been either neglected or forgotten. One is that all these countries over the history of the last 200 years, or in some cases longer, have been countries that have been in a difficult position between different powers, and they tried to create their own state and, to the extent possible, have a homogeneous, ethnically homogeneous state. And this is exactly what we see, what happened particularly after the end of the communism and fall of the Berlin Wall. If you look at, for example, Poland, obviously it didn't happen then, but it happened after 1945, a society which was very heterogeneous, where you had Germans, Ukrainians, Jews, and Poles, became 99% Polish. You see that with the split between Czech and Slovak republics. Hungary was always, after the World War I, homogeneous. You see it also in Croatia, with the disappearance of the Serbian minority. So all these countries became homogeneous. And the revolutions of 1989 had a very strong nationalistic element. So now one is asking these countries to actually overturn two centuries of history where they were trying to create their own nation state by accepting people who are very different from them. And I think this is what is in the background and which explains this reluctance of Poland or Hungary or actually Czech Republic or Slovakia or any of these countries to accept migrants outside of Europe.
And that's quite interesting. I mean, my own theory when looking at, for instance, the recent German election result is, and you can see a very big distinction in electoral results from former Eastern Germany to former Western Germany. And that relates to this because, I mean, former Eastern Bloc countries do not seem to have a equivalent history of immigration, as, for instance, Western Germany had after the war with Italian and Turkish immigration to rebuild. And the pattern seems to be that right-wing populists seem to be doing well in areas where there are literally problems with parallel societies and also in the areas where there are literally no immigrants whatsoever. So the theory then goes that the people who don't have a history or experience with immigration look at the hotspots think we do not want to become like them, mm-hmm. ignoring the 98% of cases where it just works fine, and therefore sort of you have the manifestation of a cultural rejection. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, you know, there it's a very difficult to kind of draw the conclusions. Again, I was saying before, I really am a firm believer that economics is very important. But as I explained, which I, in the case of Eastern Europe, I think there is also historical background that matters. And very often, we saw that in the case of Brexit, we find that the areas with lowest percentage of actually foreign-born have apparently voted the strongest against more migration. And that too, I think, can be explained not only by the fact that, they don't want to be, they are afraid of London, for example, but I believe that the large cities that have had, as you said, experience for many years, or actually in some cases centuries, with migrants, are actually able to absorb that they have seen this happen and they were basically functioning nevertheless well. I mean, another case is Vienna. Vienna has, for example, I think more than one third of the population that is non-Austrian born. But the in smaller cities where basically you have one a couple of shops and one cafe or a restaurant and maybe, I don't know, 50 people or 200 people or 2,000 people, I think there is a kind of a fear that your way of life would be really radically changed by the introduction of relatively small number of people who are very different from you. So I think it's actually, there is some maybe reason behind more rural areas and smaller areas being paradoxically more afraid of migration than the bigger ones.
Yeah, I mean, Brexit is another good example for this. I mean, I think you have this very strong socioeconomic explanation for why a large part of the deindustrialized north of England was supporting Brexit. But, you know, the economic argument becomes more difficult when you look at Seven Oaks in Kent, which is sort of a rich commuter town. So it seems to be that some sort of cultural factors seem to be at play there as well. But if we, towards the end of this, can pull it back towards inequality in the meta framework of globalization, mm-hmm. and also maybe the migration issue, which is set to become more pronounced going forward, if you look at the reasons why people migrate. Yeah, yeah. If you look at this and put yourselves into the shoes of policymakers in Europe or even elsewhere, sort of what would your key policy priorities be to address the most dramatic effects?
You know, it's good actually that we talked about migration. I'm not obviously a migration specialist. I simply came to migration as another manifestation of globalization. Technically speaking, migration is no different than studying movement of capital. You know, one factor of production, another factor of production. But there is a difference because politically it is different. So what I would like actually to sort of to have policymaker focus is on longer term. And particularly for Europe, it is the question of how to deal with migration. And the reason why I think it's really so crucial for Europe is because of two developments. One is that Europe, as we know it now, is composed of countries with generally either stagnant or declining population. So we know basically that Europe will decline in terms of population by maybe within next, in the next 50 years. This may not be a huge decline, but it will be stagnation or slight decline. On the other hand, we have Africa, which is now in terms of ratio, sub-Saharan Africa has about twice as many people as the EU, but that ratio will become something 5-1 towards the end of this century. And with large gaps, and that's the second point, large gaps in income, which are unlikely to be bridged in any significant manner between now and then, we have really an incredible pressure for migration, which would only get greater and will be exacerbated. And I think the policymakers in Europe should really think about a sort of a sustainable or somewhat sustainable way and somewhat controlled way to actually channel this migration. And I believe that should be done jointly by the European Union and by the African Union, probably through some quota systems. I also believe that there should be so-called circular migration, that people go to rich countries, work there for 5 years and go back. But in any way, whatever model one chooses, I think that's something that Europe and Africa have really an incentive to look forward to, actually, in a sense of preempting the emergence of the problem to the extent that it's possible, rather than solving the problem every summer, you know, by sending Frontex more ships and having, of course, all these intra-European issues between, of course, Italy and Greece as recipients in one hand, and the rest of Europe. So I really think that's something that one needs, really, leaders who can think about the future, and would include also much greater probably help for Africa. And one small detail there, which ironically may be good for Europe, is that if Chinese investments in Africa are actually bearing fruit and they help Africa grow faster, actually that would be good for Europe too, because the migration pressure from Africa would be less. So we again see this interdependency of the world there.
I mean, it seems to me that, especially in the wake of the refugee crisis in Europe, we have to start by disentangling a few things that are lumped together, which is the one is freedom of movement within the European
right.
Union. The second one is non-EU immigration into
right.
European countries and asylum. So, especially in the UK, you can see all of these different elements lumped together
Absolutely.
And it doesn't help you deal with it. And it seems to me that, of course, we have a strong framework for freedom of movement within the European Union.
Right.
We need a framework for the discussion in Germany is about an immigration law for non-EU immigration. And at the same time, you know, I think you should have an interface between asylum policy and an migration law, because you would like to set an incentive. So, for
Absolutely.
Instance, if somebody arrives as an asylum seeker and the stay might be temporary due to the legal
right.
status, and for instance, the civil war in Syria ends. So if that person then fulfills certain criteria, such as speaks the language, is integrated in the labor market, and so on and so forth, there should be an interface for transitioning a asylum seeker, refugee, towards the migration route. So, and I don't personally see these interfaces too much developed at the moment. Would you see that kind of...
I totally agree. And actually, I think that it's good that you mentioned these three different types, because I think on two of them, we have more or less clear rules. And then... migration within EU is very clear. UK may not actually sort of participate in that or like it, but the rules, I think, are clear. Then when it comes to asylum, these are international rules, which go back to actually period between the two wars. And there, again, the rules are clear. The conflicts, of course, lead to the movements of people. I'm from former Yugoslavia, I'm from Serbia. Lots of people moved from Bosnia, and actually over 2 million people, I think, who at some point were displaced, internally displaced, or actually looked for asylum in other countries. But this was a conflict, but the conflict ended. Then the part which is totally unregulated and is very unclear is this migration outside EU into the EU. And there we actually face every summer issues, and we conflate the two things. We conflate Syria with immigration from Bangladesh, Pakistan, or, you know, Mali, or Madagascar, well, not Madagascar, maybe Mauritania, into Europe. And these are really two different issues. And we have seen actually people who claim to be from Syria, but they're from somewhere else, because they want to go under the package of the asylum. But that's a different rule there. And I think what Europe needs, and I think African Union needs, is really that middle part, which is really quite undefined.
Exactly, because the absence of this clear framework for
Absolutely.
Non-EU immigration actually sets the incentive for people to claim asylum, even though their migration might be due to economic reasons. And finally, apart from sorting out migration,
right.
which will, I'm sure, be at
a
the
small
forefront.
Issue, yeah.
A very small issue will be at the forefront of policy discussions in the next few years. Any other specific policy measures to address inequality in particular? In the European Union, I mean, especially what we discussed also, you know, what can the European Union do, and what should individual member states do in order to address the biggest problems with related to inequality?
You know, when we talk about individual countries or individual member states of the European Union, the contrast, which is so obvious for any individual country, is that our incomes are more and more determined at global level, because we are competing one way or another with the rest of the world. You know, many of the jobs even that we are doing, for example, you know, people who give lectures and so on. Now, actually, they can give them also lectures remotely. So you don't have, you know, have to be physically present there, which may be good for some professors who might make actually lots of money because their lectures are being listened to, but we actually put out our job others. So we are really competing globally. However, whenever we lose, whenever we have trouble with jobs, whenever we have trouble with our incomes, our wages, and so on, we have to go to one level, which is national, because there is no global level. So there is a disconnect. In some sense, in the past, when the economies were relatively closed, your problem, your income was nationally determined, and your sort of problem solver was national government. Now, national government is really in the operation of mopping up the issues that are very often raised by globalization. So the tools are at the level of national government. So when we talk about taxation, when we talk about unemployment, pensions, health policy, they're all national. So it's very well known that, you know, you can, of course, by increasing the minimum wage, by actually enabling easier trade union, giving greater trade union rights and so on, you can actually do things better for the labor force of workers. Particularly when I meant trade union, I meant United States in particular, not Europe. So we have the means to do that, making education much more accessible and so on. But they're at the national level, and what nations can do nowadays is limited by globalization. So that's this difficulty. Maybe some countries would actually like to increase taxation, but they're really limited to the extent that they can do that because of tax competition, because of the ability of capital and labor to move. So there is a limit to what national governments can do to solve the problems which arise in many instances because of globalization. So that's where I see this, a very difficult contrast, and that's why I'm not too critical of the policies, because I see policymakers working within a framework which does not allow them, or population, doesn't allow them to become more generous, simply because becoming more generous would actually be, in some cases, destructive of their advantage on the level of worldwide competition.
So we also have, in the first instance, to solve a lot of collective action problems.
We have huge collective action problems, because when you look at that, there is a collective action problem which is at global level. We talked today, for example, about labor rights, which should be codified globally. We do have this problem there, because obviously the labor rights are very different in different countries, and they are not being codified, and the role of the ILO has been relatively limited. And we don't even, as we heard today, actually, we don't even have sort of very clear knowledge or an index for these rights across the countries. So that's the one problem, which is an interstate problem at the global level. But then we have a collective action problem at each individual country level. And the two, of course, are interdependent. I believe if we were actually doing better between nation states globally, then part of that collective action problem would be more soluble at the level of nation state. Maybe it's too abstract, but I want to say the following. If we were to actually agree on minimum labor rights, then that enables a country then to follow more pro-labor policies, because it knows that it cannot be undercut by somebody else. That's the basic story.
Okay, well, Branko Milanović, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.